From Brighton and Hove Museums, this is Tell Me About the Chamber Pots, a five-part podcast series about a year of innovative experiments in digital storytelling across our museum spaces.
Hello, I'm Charlotte Petz, and I've worked alongside Brighton and Hove Museums on various different projects over the past few years, including producing podcasts and looking at new ways to tell stories. Over the past 18 months, led by former head of digital Kevin Bacon, Brighton and Hove Museums has run several live experiments in different kinds of community and digital storytelling. We've worked with tech companies, academics, and most importantly, volunteers from across our Brighton and Hove communities. We've unpacked the different ways people interact with exhibits, and we've experimented with new cutting-edge tools and methods for telling stories to better help bring the museum to life.
Episode 2, 1 Minute Wonders.
Through 2022 into early 2023, a dedicated group of volunteers took part in writing content for the new 1 Minute Experience app. This was designed by the IT University of Copenhagen in collaboration with Brighton and Hove Museums. Back in 2019, before the pandemic, Brighton Museum had been the first host for an early beta version of this app. Then in 2023, it was live tested at the 1 Minute Experience exhibition, which ran in Brighton Museum from January until June 2023. Our volunteers created the content, and we even removed all conventional labelling from the items on display, which was an unsettling surprise for many visitors. For this episode, Kevin Bacon speaks to the group of volunteers who created the labelling content for the exhibition.
My name is Maria Gambler, and I want to involve with some museums because I finished my master in the University of Brighton. And I want to see how can you work and write labels, not with the traditional way, and how to be much more engagement for the visitors without any social backgrounds. That's for me, it was very important to involve with that.
I'm Ian, and my involvement came from working with the Dome as a heritage volunteer, and we actually also did a 1 minute app project which dealt with about a dozen objects at the Dome, and we created a trail for that. So when the opportunity came up to be involved in this, I thought, had a bit of experience, really enjoyed doing that, like museums myself, so that's why I put my name down for it.
I'm Jill, and like Ian, came from being a heritage volunteer at the Dome, and we were involved with the 1 minute app project there. But I've always been a keen museum goer, and I've always felt quite strongly about how things are labelled or how inaccessible they are.
I'm Avril Kirk, a retired teacher. I would say I was interested in storytelling, particularly because being an English teacher and also enjoying it all my life, really. I think possibly from my background, which is Irish, storytelling was part of that, so it appealed to me. And of course I love coming to museums and art galleries, and when I got the opportunity, I was delighted to combine those two interests.
This project was always very, very experimental, and I know people are often a bit concerned about bringing volunteers into an experimental project, because normally you think you bring volunteers in to help actually create something. But you think, well, are the motivations necessarily there if they're creating something that simply might not work? Now, did that occur to you at any point as being something that potentially put you off, or the flip side, you might have found that actually quite exciting about the project?
I think I found it exciting, the idea of looking closely at a picture and abandoning the usual labelling idea, but just looking at what the story might be being told in that picture inspired me immediately.
I think this is the most interesting, that we can tell our story with historical details through the stories or without, but a different story, not just a story from a curator that is very traditional, like name, historical event, and that's it. A different story through the painting. It's, for me, was exciting.
So often you go on tours in the museum with different sorts of technology, and you've abandoned it within about 5 minutes of getting into the museum because it doesn't work properly for you. which means that people are designing things that aren't working with the people that are using it. And I always find that maddening, and I'm very impatient with it. So the chance to get involved with something and say, no, this doesn't work at all, you know, we'll try again, we'll do it this way, it works if you do this, because you're always going to get lots of different people into the museum with different experiences and different tech. And if it's not working easily with people, it's not working at all.
For me, it was a bit of a balance, because in the back of my mind, not being the most tech-savvy person, I didn't know where that was going to go, but I was up for the challenge. And then on the flip side of that, it was just the opportunity to put a different hat on and approach this if I was a visitor, and bring all my experiences myself of going to museums for many years and thinking, what's going to be the most accessible thing about this to make it the most accessible for most people. But it also got me thinking about objects generally, not objects that are just in a case, but everyday objects that we tend to forget just tell a story themselves without us having to actually make something up for the objects that we were dealing with here.
I mean, for me, one of the interesting things about this project has been particularly the 1 minute strand of it, is that we did come in with a particular piece of technology in mind and wanted to see how far it could go. And we very quickly got to the point where we thought, actually, this has burst its boundaries. It's actually just not going to work without a lot of investment in how we do this. And I think, Jill, you were really useful, actually, for pointing out that your own experience of going to museums, almost the less technology, the better. Yeah. And that's why we've kind of moved to a model. We've almost regress the technology to something much more simpler. I think it's still not there yet, but it feels like it's on a, you know, a path to something that will be more sustainable and we can expand on. And as I say, that wasn't something I'd anticipated at the outset, because I was always much more interested in the storytelling component of this, and I tended to assume the technology was fairly static, so I was actually quite surprised to suddenly find. But it's very useful, and certainly would inform a direction of travel to, you know, think a lot more about the technology and actually how to shape it around. It's quite common in digital projects to bring people in to do user testing, but not to do user testing at the same time as content creation. But I felt that was quite valuable, because you do see it from sort of different sides during part of that process. Avril and Maria, you obviously were working from a pre-selected set of works. Mm-hmm. What was it that really motivated you to choose the works that you did?
Me, I love politics. Mm. And I chose the political caricatures. I have no idea about British political history. No idea. And I was like, I want to know about that. And I find it very fascinating, because I do the thought in my mind, like, that was the memes of today. Like, my people in my age, they use memes for everything. Political, economical status, everything. And that for me was the political caricatures of the past. They express the opinion of the people, and I want to know that opinion through the caricatures, and to learn also about the history. I find it fascinating.
So I have to say, I was both surprised and impressed that you chose those words, because obviously you're Greek, aren't you?
Yes, originally. I have no idea. I didn't have idea about the political history of Britain that period. But I learned it, and I enjoyed a lot. Like, I will do it again 100%.
I mean, it's great to see you take that deep dive, because, you know, those caricatures are quite complicated.
Yes, obviously, it was.
You know, most people, you know, educated in this country or grew up in this country wouldn't know much about Regency politics. Yes. I mean, it's a really complicated world. But you did a wonderful job bringing those to life, and I think making those connections as well with modern-day memes. Thank How about you, Avril?
I chose an insect, and then I chose pictures with people in it, and I think, and the colours. I'm very affected by colours. I respond to them. But the insect, I don't know, other than it was so intricate. It was 17th century, I think, and it started me thinking, I suppose, because of the times we live in and the interest we have in the natural world. That was one reason that inspired me. But the other, it was the story in the people. And it wasn't until I got further into the pictures and looked a little bit about their history that I realised how important it was to follow that through, because there were some amazing stories that unfolded.
Ian, Jill, obviously you had a sort of different position with the trowel because we effectively let you take free rein across the museum, which had its own challenges and things being suddenly removed when I wasn't expecting it. But what motivated you to choose the works that you did?
For me, clearly there was scope for interpretation with everything that was here, and I wanted to do a bit of that in the same way as people write novels, but within novels describe historical events. I was sort of thinking in those terms. And I know we were confined to 160 characters, so again, it was a sort of balance. But I also made the decision that I wanted to take on something I knew a bit about, because I had previously been quite involved in work on British youth subcultures, so what I'd chosen sort of fitted in with that, and I don't really know much about chamber pots, so that's the route I went down. But that was the restriction for me, it was the limitations of how much you could use, so every swipe I tried to have a bit of interpretation, played around a bit, but at the same time a bit of factual stuff as well.
For me, the choice was easy because it's a museum I've been visiting since I was small. I chose the Galley Cats and the big model of George IV that was in the children's parade. I went straight to those just because I knew the stories. The Galley Cat I knew better because they used to have the big model in the museum that you put money in when you were a child and you made it purr. And I think it must have been about 30 years later when I realised that the actual models were somewhere else and they weren't as big as that. But finding out how they were made and who made them and the whole story behind them was really interesting. I knew nothing about that. And it was a joy to find out that because I'd only known the other part of the story as a visitor over many years.
And I have to say, we haven't got a title for this podcast yet, but I know nothing about chamber pots. Seems like quite a good title, I think. We shall see. In terms of the story writing, I'd like to focus a little bit on the kind of one-minute approach, because when you take away the technology, the core of the idea really is that idea that you tell a story in very short chunks to keep someone's attention focused and, you know, keep someone engaged with an object for 60 seconds, which to most people doesn't seem like a huge ask, but if you look at how people use museums or you know anything about the research, you realise that's quite ambitious. So when you were first confronted with using the one-minute editor, how did you find that experience?
I started to do the research about the political history and it was like so complicated. And I was like, oh, I first need to try to write something on the app, but the limit on the character was too little. And I was like, come on, how can I explain all of this complicated stuff in so limited words? But I tried to write a little story. I keep the characters, the first characters in each story, and I realized that it's much more easiest for everyone to read that and understand what is the meaning without a bigger amount of characters that will end much more complicated for a visitor that have a different background and no idea about the British history. I have the thought, like, as me, I have no idea about that. A lot of people that can visit the Brighton Museum, also, maybe they don't have idea about that story. I need to do it as much more accessible as I can for everyone.
Any other thoughts on your
editor? Yeah, I felt very strongly that you need to begin with what's on the label, what it is, who did it, what the age is, who did it, because partly from a technical point of view, because if a museum's busy or like me, you've got poor eyesight, you need to get really close in order to get all that information, which is annoying for the people around you and you can't always read it very easily. But then say something about why it's important or why it's significant or have you noticed? I mean, for the Galley Cats, I'd never noticed before that they're wearing little chokers with a picture of a dog on the choker. Mm. So I wanted to point out that somebody else is looking at that. Can you find the dog in the picture? Because it's not what you see immediately. And as you go around the museum, you quite often hear people saying, I wonder why, or who, or what. And you want to be the voice at their shoulder saying, how did you know, you know, that's important, because, you know, the George IV, mm. I don't think some people who don't know Brighton won't associate that with the pavilion, and I don't think you know that necessarily unless you come from here.
I'd never noticed the dogs on the gallows catch until the original piece, and I've been working here 20 years. I mean, Ian Avril, again, what were your kind of responses to it?
Well, I wrote it freehand at first and then realised that it's got to be a lot less. I found it very helpful, the fact that it cut you off and it made me look back and think, what is it I really want to say? And rejig it so that I could fit in what I wanted to say. So it was a really good guide. And at the time, and I think I probably mentioned to you, because of a history of in education, I thought what a wonderful tool it was to, you know, get anybody could sit down and yes. write for a minute, and how excellent it would be for a bigger audience to inspire them. So give this to a young person or whatever person and say, what do you think of? So it opened up a lot, but I did have to really, you know, restrain myself.
Yeah, the mechanic, when I started, kept on telling me, you're not very good at this, because it got to that point and said, you've only got five words left, and I think it was about 35 in total, that was the equivalent of 160. But before I started, I did actually take a visit to Delaware and a few other places just to see what they were doing and their approach, and it was quite helpful. And I just sort of made the decision, I know we've all said this, that... you know, I didn't want to be writing really about the Lambretta for the sake of the Brighton Bike Club, or about the leather jacket for the James Dean Appreciation Society, because what's the point of that, the people that know? So I had to come from that angle, as I said before, of, oh, this is, you know, this is interesting. I might want to go out and find a bit more about this afterwards.
When I tried the trail for other things that other people had done, I found it really useful because it made me look at things really carefully. And there was a picture of a forest that had people in it, and I don't think I'd ever seen the people in it before until it was pointed out on the app. And sometimes I think the resolution on the pictures on your phone are better than the picture on the wall, because you can actually get closer to it and see it really clearly. Having it on your phone and being able to look at it, not even in the museum, I found really useful.
Do you feel that as a museum visitor, you are often inclined to actually use your phone to enhance the experience? I mean, has this project changed that perception, or is it something you would have done anyway if the offer was there?
Interestingly, I've subsequently been to Charleston, where they're using an app, and I think I'm, by instinct, not inclined to use an app anywhere, but I downloaded it at Charleston and didn't use it very much there because the signal wasn't great, but read it all when I came away because it was answering questions that were in my head as I went round. But I didn't use it there. I was looking at what I was seeing there, not what was on my phone there. I think you can look wider than just actually using it in the building.
But would you prefer to access the content while you're actually physically on site?
No, not necessarily, because I think you need to look at the things that are around you rather than what's on your phone there. And I think sometimes people go around like this and don't notice what's in the room around them or the gardens around them. I was doing the backup stuff afterwards. I think I might even have read it before I'd gone if I'd known it existed. But I wasn't frustrated by the fact I couldn't use it in the building because it was busy while I was there anyway.
Perhaps it's a bit like taking a book out of a library.
Yeah. When places are busy, you know, you get very irritated by the people who are reading the catalogue in front of the Vermeer, so you can't actually look at the Vermeer that's on the wall.
Yeah.
Not very patient with these things.
Me, I have a conversation with a lot of friends, and a lot of them say, like, my generation is all the time in the smartphones. It's a good idea if you create a bigger connection with the new generations, that they use a lot of smartphones, to try to remove the traditional stuff, like the traditional labels, and try to bring them better when you visit the museum. Sometimes, yes, it's better, but I don't want to use every time the smartphone in the museum. I like the thought that when I leave the museum, I can go back to the website and read again if I have some questions, but yeah.
I agree with that. There were a couple of things that weren't quite right when I used my smartphone, and so being able to go home and then look, and in fact on my iPad, which brought even bigger mm-hmm. picture, really let me see in detail what I'd noticed, you know, when I'd first seen it. It really was helpful. And when I mentioned what I'd done and the project to people, I had a response from New Zealand saying how lovely and how interesting it was. And I sort of felt like it had reached out, you know, there were tendrils going all over the world. And also for my family who couldn't come, that was another way of explaining to them what was happening and how interesting it was.
I found working on both projects very liberating as far as equipment went, and for me personally, and it's made me much more open to using apps and things like that. But as everybody said, when I'm in a museum, I don't really want to be looking at my phone because I spend so much time doing it the rest of the time. I want to be there in the moment. You know, I went to the Roger Bamba exhibition and I thought, that was great, actually. It was just the right amount of content. And I didn't get the feeling that people were shuffling through and moving on. People were looking at it. That struck the right chord for me.
I think, too, with people who are on their phones a lot, in some ways engaging them with that whilst they're in a museum sometimes slows people down long enough to look at the thing that they're looking at. And I did the one about Punch and Judy, and there were children looking at it who I think were of a generation where Punch and Judy, they've never even seen it. And they were talking about why is it like that. And they had a father behind them who was trying to explain about, you know, the funny voices and sausages and hitting men hitting women over the head and a lot of things that are not regarded as politically correct. And those sorts of stories, I think if you're doing them on a phone, people do slow down long enough to read that little bit, fixing them in position long enough to look at the thing and find out something if they want to.
It's kind of getting the additional content when you want it, that sense of sort of dipping in rather than necessarily doing something like a formal trail. Because I know we talked about the content around the museum being a trail, but that was almost for want of any other better way of positioning it. Actually, not that many people want to follow something like a trail. They just want the rhythm of their own visit with whatever they're doing, and just that moment to suddenly think, what's that? I want to find out a bit more about it. Or as I think you're both saying, for accessibility, you don't want to peer at the label, you actually just want to get it onto your phone. So I think that's definitely an interesting thing to explore. What sort of response did you get from kind of friends and family? Because I know certainly Avril, I mean, you were saying you had sort of a family in New Zealand actually.
Yes, that's right. And they sent me quite a long response. In fact, a few people did. They really, I got the feeling that, you know, they were also responding to the picture as I had through the story. It was as if my eyes had, you know, how I'd seen it had triggered them into a response as well. Particularly the Margaret in New Zealand particularly liked the dragonfly. I don't know why, it sort of really resonated with her. Also, people came to the museum as a result.
Me, a lot of friends in Greece and my family see the exhibition because it was online. And they find it very interesting because, again, they didn't have the knowledge of the political history of Britain. And they find it an easy way to learn something because it's just an app. The story is small. It's not a big amount of article. And they like it. Because they saw an exhibition in Brighton through the website. I have a good feedback on that.
I think I'm famous in my family for being the least technical person in my family, so they were very scathing about my ability to be involved in anything to do with an app. But I think they've been impressed with the contents and surprised that it was me that was involved with the content, but maybe that's just my family.
No, it's not, because my son said exactly the same thing. But some of my friends came and they brought their kids with. They said, oh, surprise, surprise that you chose those three objects. And they said that their kids just did get their phones out and were happy to use their phones. And it was the idea that it was there for them to use, sort of more than what the content had to offer.
What do you feel there is the potential for museum visitors to actually access stories that aren't written by traditional museum curators?
And knowing that...
Yeah, knowing that quite explicitly, yeah.
I think it opens up all sorts of possibilities. One, that it's something that they might seek out to get involved in with themselves, but also it's sort of that idea of bottom-up as opposed to top-down, ordinary people, if you like, that are doing this stuff and coming at it from their own angle.
I think it has to start from the facts about what is this, who is it by, who is it, when was it made, but trying to say something about why this is here and why this is important and why other people talk about it in museums, I think is really important. If you're coming at it from not a point of view of expertise, there's been a lot in the news recently about the Vermeer at the Rijksmuseum, and lots of people talk about Vermeer, and unless you look at the pictures, you can't necessarily see why they are still important now and why people do queue up to go and see them. And I'm not saying that, you know, the model of something that was in Brighton Festival is in any way in the same category, but it is an important thing in the history of this city and how people behave here. And just opening that door a bit and saying this is important because this is why people are looking at it.
Do you feel sometimes having that story told by someone who very obviously isn't an expert does make it feel more accessible to other people?
Yes. I think if you're going from the point of view saying, I really like this because...
I think it does open up art to everybody. A person is responding to a piece of art in their particular way, which may not be the usual. And then it sort of allows everybody to say, yes, I like that. And, oh, what are they doing? Or what's happening here? Or where's that path going? To anything that they see, that they start asking questions. And for me, it triggers the imagination and the creativity.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be academic, does it?
No.
It's the way it's presented as well, isn't it? That's the two sides to it.
Yeah, for me... I agree with, we open a door, and also we do the art much more accessible for everyone, because if we want to decolonize our museums, our collections, and how we tell the stories from our collection, what stories we say, from what background, and if everyone can tell a different story, we have much more opinions, and we do the art much more accessible and equal of all of us. That's, for me, it's the most important thing, because right now we have the museum that is very special, very academic, and the doors is a little bit closed for everyone. And we need to try to fix that.
Like, I know on certainly the 1 minute display, I think it was Barbara, who wrote all of hers in the form of poems.
That's
and I thought that was so interesting because, you know, if you were a curator and a very good poet, you still wouldn't dare actually write that, because people would say, why are you doing this? But actually, if you come from outside of that professional practice, you have full license to do that. So that's one of the quite exciting things about this project.
I think, too, sometimes people who know a huge amount about a subject don't always understand why it's not accessible to other people, because if they're very passionate and knowledgeable about it, Yes. They're not coming from the point of view of, I really like this because. Mm-hmm. And they have a whole wealth of experience and education and knowledge that is informing their view. But if you haven't got any of that, you can say that it's a Rembrandt picture or it's a royal palace. Mm. But that doesn't mean anything if you don't know, if you haven't come from that, you don't know why any of those things are significant.
Mm. It's also that thing about history being filtered, and this is an opportunity to actually grab it yourself and put it back out there in a different way.
Mm. So hence you were doing a lot of thinking about who the person, the other end of the story might be.
Of course, I can't see that I think you have to do that, really. I'm going to throw it back to you. Had there been any feedback for yourself, people coming talking about the approach, because they can see that it wasn't necessarily what they'd been used to?
To be honest, it's quite mixed at the moment, right. But nothing that really puts me off. I think the main problem we have in terms of the data around the 1 minute display is people are puzzled by it. But I think a lot of that is not the content, it's the onboarding. You know, people come into a gallery, they're suddenly told there's no labels, which people really disliked. Mm. I mean, I thought, nobody would notice if we don't put labels up, people really dislike that. Mm. And then they're presented with stories and they're just a bit puzzled by the concept. I think some people really like the stories, judging by the data, it's very mixed. The onboarding is really the challenge, actually. Mm. I think certainly anecdotally, lots of people have said they kind of really like the content, they find it quite fresh. But at the moment, it just feels a slightly strange step for museum visitors to take. So I think part of the future of this project is thinking about how do you actually wire it into the whole museum experience, because you can do it, but you probably need to do it at the front entrance rather than something someone stumbles across halfway through the museum.
Yeah.
What's this?
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of very unfamiliar things they've got to negotiate.
I think it works best if it's an alternative to any other way that people might choose to move around a museum. So it's like going around with a reasonably knowledgeable friend where you say, have you seen this bit? Or you might be interested in that. Or on the first floor there is it, have a look at. And then you can add to the stories about this particular item or object or whatever. I mean, in the Dome, for example, there's some posters with tickets on the wall about concerts they have been, and once you point it out, people are always fascinated by the fact that you could go and see a band or another for 1 and 6 or whatever it was back in the day, or people begin to tell their own stories about, yes, I came to that one, or I know about that, or whatever. And I think that's the sort of function that it can usefully perform, and then people who want to know more about the item itself or the history of that particular form or item can go down that road, but it might just be a sort of nudging operation that it's doing.
And I think that's certainly where I see the potential of this kind of work, but it's thinking about it in a much more nuanced and almost kind of fractured way than the traditional audio guide, which in the pavilion you pick it up as you come in, it's glued to your ear, and the idea is you follow right the way through. But people don't, they actually use it more complicated ways than that, but it does need a lot of thinking. This process has been really useful.
Thank you so much for listening. We're very grateful to our volunteers for donating their time to this podcast, as well as their huge contributions to the project as a whole. Join us next time on Tell Me About the Chamber Pots.
Tell Me About the Chamber Pots is a Brighton and Hove Museums production. It was written, presented and edited by Charlotte Petz and me, Chris Thorpe Tracy. The main interviewer was Kevin Bacon. This series is produced by Nick Kay and Kevin Bacon for Brighton and Hove Museums. Find us online at brightonmuseums.org.uk. That's brightonmuseums.org.uk.